Try the joke again. Anyways, what we're going to do today is talk about the existence of God. Now, this sort of seems like a very dry topic, and it probably is to some extent, because we're just going to go over a lot of facts and figures and probably not spend that much time in the scriptures, because what I'm trying to do is to give you a platform for which you could talk to your friends. So a little bit, this is going to be like drinking water from a fire hose, because this could be about 7 or 8 sessions that I'm trying to compress into one. So we're going to lightly touch on each of these topics and go through them rather quickly. But before I do, let me begin with a little history. The gentleman on the left is George Whitefield. Now, most of you probably know a little bit about George Whitefield. He was here at the late turn of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, and was one of the major movers and shakers that was responsible for, or at least associated with, the Second Great Awakening in the United States. Unlike the First Great Awakening, which was very much based upon doctrinally correct sermons that really grabbed people's emotions because it first grabbed their intellect, his preaching was much more focused on grabbing people's emotions and sort of like, does truth really matter type thing. And so that was the beginning, of the end of Christian academia. The next guy on the other side is George Finney, and some of you may know him. And he was the beginning of the Pentecostal movement, or at least was one of the major forces behind that back again and around the turn of the 19th century. So then it became more the importance was not so much do you actually know what God is about, but do you know him? Do you feel him? Do you actually experience him? And so what ended up happening is instead of having sermons that were really appealing to the mind, they more or less sort of were carefully packaged sermons that would deliver a message. They, in other words, Christian conferences and Christian teachings became commercialized, if you will. In other words, it didn't matter what you had to sell was true or not, it's just did it sound good. And that's what had basically happened. So the teaching appealed to the emotions, and you emphasized this personal experience with God. And really what happened was we lost our ability to discuss and to think and to look at the principles of the scriptures. And while all this is happening in the United States, things are happening in Europe. And, you know, just like Christ said, no good thing can come out of Nazareth, you know, sometimes people say maybe no good thing can come out of Europe. But what happened is there's a lot of philosophy that came out of Europe that really sort of, if you will, unsettled things in Christianity. First, there was this gentleman, David Hume, who sort of said, well, miracles are not possible. And there's a bunch of arguments for that, which we're not going to go into today. And basically what he did is sort of say that the arguments for the existence of God are ineffective. Prior to that, people used to sort of say, well, we believe in God because it was rational to believe in God. And he was sort of saying, it's not rational to believe in God because you really don't know why you believe in him. You just start believing in him because you feel like you believe in him. And of course, when you're trained in churches which are only training in emotions, you'd sort of say, well, I guess he's right. Maybe there's no rational reason to believe in God. And Immanuel Kant came alongside, and he's actually a believer. But his problem was, is he also looked and said, sort of say, I really can't know anything unless I can feel it with my senses. If I can't touch it, smell it, feel it, you know, how do I really know it's true? And so because of that, he used what's called a form of philosophy called logical positivism, where it's sort of if you can't touch and feel it, you just don't know it's true. And so he says, since we can't sense God, I mean, you can't touch and feel him, how do you really know he's there? And therefore, we really can't know God. Now, that's what his arguments were. He actually was a believer and said there's other ways to know God, but they don't really hold water, so we're not going to get into those today. And then this guy, I guess some of you might know that friendly bearded fellow. His name is Charles Darwin. And he came up in the late 1800s or mid-1800s with the fact that we can actually have naturalistic explanations for what we see out there. You know, instead of the fact that there was a creator God who designed everything, there's now a natural forces in nature designed everything. And now you can explain the origin of life or the origin of the universe or in Darwin's case, the origin of species, not through supernatural means, but rather through natural means. And so all of a sudden, atheism became a comfortable place for people that have a rational mind to sit. A rational, sinful mind, mind you, but a rational mind nonetheless. Uh-oh. Boy, this doesn't work very well. Okay. Let's see, what if I do this again? Oh, good. So it works that way. Okay. I was a little worried about this one. So the church retreats. So the American church retreats. What happens is we get in these little holy huddles. We get together and we have little impact on the culture around us. And we sort of see reason as the enemy of faith because we've been attacked for the fact that there's no rational belief, reason to believe in God. We sort of see reason as being, well, if you have to reason something, it's not something you have to believe. You can just reason your way out, and then faith goes away. And people view reason and faith as being opposite of the other, and they're not, okay? And now all of a sudden it became the difference between what they call black robe preachers and white robe scientists. I mean, who really is the final authority here? Who really knows? Is it those black robe preachers that go to these seminaries and they talk about a bunch of things? What gives them the authority? But you know, science really does have authority. I mean, those people, you know, they do this technology stuff that works half the time. You know, so they have to be right, you know? So, you know, so science is seen. And then church has become all this collection of how-to things, you know, how to be a good husband. Now, I'm not arguing the fact that those things aren't important. They are part of what we need to learn. But unfortunately, that's not the only thing that's important. And in fact, if you don't have some basis behind that, we become just basically psychological self-help groups here, which hopefully it's not. Many of you know about the Scopes trial. The Scopes trial in the 1924, give or take a couple years. Basically, a gentleman named Scopes taught evolution, which was forbidden by Tennessee law. There's a big trial. And James Bryan, who was not a scholar, was for the prosecution, but not a biblical scholar. He got up there and had to defend the scriptures, and he yammered around for a while. And basically, Christianity went into retreat because they couldn't even defend the scriptures. The church no longer loves the Lord their God with all their mind. I'm always struck by the fact that the Christ in the greatest commandment says you're supposed to love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength. But yet somehow loving the Lord your God with all your mind kind of gets lost in the shuffle there, you know? I mean, we want a feel-good God. We want a God that makes us feel good, and we want to be able to feel Him and know Him. But in order to relate to Him intellectually, it's kind of like, well, that's just too hard for us. We just don't want to approach that. And instead it becomes, what can God do for us for our felt needs? And that's where we are with the Christian churches nowadays. So what happens is now that the Christian churches have done this, atheism has emerged, and what we call militant atheism has emerged. A gentleman named Richard Dawkins, who you may or may not have heard, published a book in 1986 called The Blind Watchmaker, basically sort of saying we can explain everything we can by natural forces. Sam Harris came up with a book in 2004, said The End of Faith, basically saying that, you know, nowadays we don't really need to have faith because everything can be explained by science. Richard Dawkins, again, just recently in 2006, his book, The God Delusion, basically sort of says people that were grown up in Christian churches and raised in Christian churches are Christians because their parents taught them. But once they realize and get exposed to rational truth, they will no longer be Christians because Christianity is irrational. And so what we're left with is the fact that those of us are all deluded, according to Dawkins. And then finally there's a letter to Christian Nation came out about a year ago. So these are what happens. These are what our co-workers, our friends, our family, these are what people that aren't brothers and sisters of the Lord are reading. And so my question is how can you help them? I mean, if you don't even know that this exists out there and they're reading this drivel, if you will, then how are you going to be able to answer their questions? And if our purpose and being here on earth is not only to grow and to know the Lord, but also to influence our friends so they may also know the joy of loving the Lord Jesus Christ, I think that the question is, how are you going to help them? And also, when your kids, most of your kids already may have kids in college or going to college or soon to go to college, you know, what's going to happen when they're confronted with all these high-powered academic individuals that sound really smart but really don't know the truth? How are they going to stand strong? So, let's talk about the existence of God. And let me go back for why we're doing this here in Berean Bible Church. Well, if you are looking back at Acts, and you'll get to this in probably 2010, but when you get to this passage in Acts 17, you'll find out that Paul, his methodology of going to different places was to first to go to a synagogue and then reason with them. And so what happens is he would dispute with them, discuss with them, he would reason with them out of the scriptures, and that was his method. And the reason he would do that is that these were people that already were familiar with the scriptures. They sort of believed the scripture. They may have misunderstood the scriptures, but at least you didn't have to sort of say, the scriptures are the word of God, and they already knew that. They already took that as their presupposition. But unfortunately, when he went to the pagans, he didn't sort of say, thus saith the Lord, because they didn't know him. So what he did instead is he walked around Athens, which was a godless city, and he knew that they had all these different altars everywhere, and as they were looking at the different altars and everything, he sort of says, I noticed that there was an altar to an unknown God. So you guys must be religious. But instead of reasoning from his scripture, he sort of says, I want to declare to you this God who made the world and all things therein. And really, that's our message when we go to unbelievers. We don't take necessarily what's in the Bible and sort of say, and begin with that necessarily when we're trying to meet with them. Because they may be at the point that they don't even believe in absolute truth. So what good is it going to do to sort of say the Bible is the word of God and it's truth when they sort of don't believe that? So our purpose today is to sort of say, to take somebody who at least can sort of look out there and see nature and see everything else like that and see the world that made them and go back and see if it really declares the glory of God. So the arguments for the existence of God. There's going to be what I call the big two, which I'm going to spend a little bit of time on. The cosmological, which will argue from the cause of the universe. The teleological, which will argue from the design. And don't worry, we'll go over this in a little bit. The little two, and I call them the little two because they're not as big, as not as influential. And to be honest with you, most people have trouble understanding them. Or like the ontological, we'll get into that one. And the axiological, we're all those, so the moral argument. And these are all four different arguments for the existence of God. And basically look at this as tools in your tool chest. Because what you're going to do is you're going to come across somebody, and this happens to me time and time again, and they'll bring up something, and I don't have to sit there and sort of say, well, let's start at Genesis 1. I can actually sort of pick up my tool thing and pull out the tool I need for that person at that particular moment. They may not believe, but that's not my problem. That's God's problem. Okay? All right. Cosmological argument. Let me just give you a biblical basis for this. We already read this earlier. The heavens are declaring the glory of God. And so also that Paul said in Romans 1:20 that the invisible things, and I focused on that word invisible, from the creation of the world declares the things and they are clearly seen. In other words, we can't see God. He's invisible. But we can know that he exists because the creation of the world makes it so clearly evident. And that's really what cosmological argument is. It's basically to argue for the existence of the Creator based upon creation. Okay, so here's our basic structure. It begins with what's called the principle of sufficient reason. What's the principle of sufficient reason? This is a philosophical argument. It's not a biblical argument. We're basically going in the realm of the unsaved here and looking at what they think. A principle of sufficient reason says that every event has a reason for the event that is sufficient to explain that event. So, for example, if all of a sudden you saw a dead body in front of you and had a knife in his heart, there has to be a sufficient reason for that to occur. Okay? The sufficient reason may have been something such as somebody stabbed that person, that's why they have a knife in the heart. A sufficient reason might be that he stabbed himself, it could have been suicide. Or a sufficient reason, I guess, could have been that aliens were flying around in spaceships and throwing knives down and it just happened to hit him. Okay? They're all sufficient reasons. But an insufficient reason would be, it just happened. That's an insufficient reason. It just doesn't happen. So the principle of sufficient reason means that you have to explain something that's sufficient enough to explain the event you see. Okay? So you can't just sort of pick a part of this. You can't sort of say, well, he was walking along the road. Well, yeah, so a lot of people walk around the road, but most of them don't have knives in them, you know? So you have to come up with a sufficient reason. So let's look at that. The universe is an event, right? It's an event. We'll call it an event. The sufficient reason for the universe is God. And so it comes in three different forms. Actually, it comes in about 15 different forms, but we'll just highlight three big ones. The Kalam argument, which I'm going to look at in detail. The Thomist argument, which is the principle is the fact that everything in this world is in motion somehow. That if everything's in motion, something stationary, unchangeable, unchangeless, had to start this thing in motion. The reason the Thomist argument doesn't work that well nowadays is that his argument was based on the fact that he thought, even though he was Catholic, thought that creation, the universe was eternal, even though the scripture says it's not. But somehow he thought that, so he had to come up with a way that just talked about motion. The Leibnizian argument sort of goes like this. There's a reason for everything, okay? Everything, and this is not really based on cause, but there's a reason for everything, you know? In other words, something happens, you sort of say, well, why'd that happen? That sort of leads to cause, but why'd that happen? So his argument goes like this. Well, there's stuff around us. Why is there something instead of nothing at all? Again, I'm not going to focus on that one. Instead, I'm going to go through the Kalam argument because I think it's the easiest one to understand. Okay, everything that begins has a cause. That's premise one. We're going to do a lot of logical stuff here, so I hope you don't mind. I mean, we've did syllogisms before, so hopefully you guys are prepared for this. Everything beginning has a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe had a cause. When you're looking at arguments, there are two principles of looking at arguments. One is validity and one is soundness. Okay? Validity means that the conclusion necessarily follows in the argument. In other words, the argument structure is correct or valid. So there's no doubt that that's a valid argument. The next question with logic is it sound, or the soundness of the argument? And that has to do with, are the premises true? Because this could be an entirely logical argument, but it could be false because the premises are false. So whether or not an argument is sound depends on whether or not the premises are true. I'm not doing so bad for time. That's good. Okay, the principle of sufficient reason. What, premise number one, to go back to it, premise number one was, again, everything in the beginning had a cause. Well, that's basically our principle of sufficient reason. Everything that begins must have had some reason to cause it to begin or to cause it to happen or whatever. So that's true by intuition, experience, the principle of sufficient reason. There's lots of reasons that say that's true. But some people that argue against the Kalam argument, will argue it because of two things. Number one, they sort of say, well, what about subatomic particles? Apparently nowadays in the 21st century, subatomic particles just seem to emerge out of nothingness, at least as best what the scientists think. Of course, there's still some theories about that, so it may not be true. But see, the problem is it doesn't arise out of nothing. You know, inside the subatomic particles, there's energy and there's other things, and we know that matter can be converted to energy, and so it's not unusual to think energy can be converted to matter. And so it doesn't really rise out of nothingness. So the argument that they can occur at a subatomic level, something can arise out of nothing, still doesn't hold water. And even if it did occur at the subatomic level, we're talking about something slightly bigger than the subatomic level here. The other thing is, some people argue that the principle of sufficient reason is true in the universe, but not of the universe. And although they make that claim, they really don't have a lot of support behind that claim. And so although they're detractors for premise number one, they don't really hold water. So most people that want to argue against this Kalam argument will sort of attack premise number two. In other words, is it true that the universe had a beginning? Well, there's only two possibilities, either it did or didn't. So let's kind of go through each one. First of all, there's a philosophical argument that actual infinities do not exist. So if you look at this, if you say that the universe existed eternally, okay, then the question is have you ever seen an actual infinity? I mean, we talk about it in mathematics a lot. You talk about rays and lines and, you know, all these other things, but actual infinities do not exist in the created reality, okay? They do not exist. So our universe is very big, but it's not infinite. Our universe has been here for a period of time, but it's not been infinite. So the argument first is a philosophical argument that actual infinities do not exist in this universe. Or another technical argument is this. Let's say you're counting. One, two, three, four. Can you ever get to infinity? No, you can't. You can't because you can always add one more number, right? Well, let's say today is today. Yesterday is minus one. Then you go minus two, minus three, minus four. Keep going back. Can you ever get to infinity? No. There's always a point where you actually get back to that. So if you have a successive number of seconds, it doesn't matter how small you make that period of time, you just can't get them to add up to infinity. It doesn't add up to infinity. So because of that, there's an impossible of forming an actual infinite by a successive addition. So because of that, the universe philosophically, not scientifically, philosophically had to have a beginning. But of course, we have to talk about science because, you know, these white robe scientists are the people that really know what's really going on, so they think. And so let's talk about this second law of thermodynamics. What that states is basically that there's a fixed amount of energy, and that as things go on, the energy is getting used up in a closed system. The universe is this huge closed system. It's slowly getting used up, and so it's running out of energy. Well, if it's running out of energy, think about a flashlight that gets started. Well, why is there any energy left? If this existed for an infinite period of time, the energy would have run out infinitely long ago, I guess. You know, so because there's actually energy here, that means there must have been some point where it had a lot of energy And although it's kind of winding down, there still was a point in time. And so again, the universe had to have a beginning. Or as most people look at the second law of thermodynamics, entropy, things with time tend to disorder. Just go home, look at one of your closets. You know, you fix it up, it all looks fine. A couple weeks later, it all looks like a mess. You know, everything tends to disorder, okay? So if this universe is eternal, then there would be so much disorder here, everything would just be completely uniform disorder, if you will. Right? But it's not. It's not that way. So because of that, the second law of thermodynamics states pretty clearly that there had to be a beginning. And that's the reason why, That's the reason why when Einstein came up with his theory of relativity, he had to put a fudge factor in a lot of his equations because he conceptualized the universe initially as being eternal. So in order to make the equations work, he had to fudge in a factor about that, because otherwise things like this happen. All right. So the universe had a beginning. More scientific evidence. Think about radioactive elements that decay into more stable elements over time. And that's, it faded on that purposely to kind of get you the idea of it's decaying. Pretty neat, huh? All right. So you start off with uranium, and uranium eventually goes to lead. Well, why is there still uranium in the world if everything will decay to lead? There's still uranium here. So again, another scientific evidence that the universe had to have a beginning, okay? So what happens is you get folks like this. This is an agnostic astronomer named Jaltro. He basically sort of says that when you peek out in the skies and you look out there, the evidence leads to the fact that there's a biblical view of the origin of the world. And then if you look at the accounts of creation in Genesis, you look at this, it just all fits. The problem is that scientists don't want to say that that happens. They don't want to look at the fact that there's actually supernatural forces, because science, philosophically, nowadays, is the study of natural causes. And they sort of say, well, we can't study the supernatural, that's the religion, therefore it's not scientific. But if you sort of say science is really a look at what the causes are, natural or supernatural, then clearly you sort of see that there's supernatural forces out there. So how do the atheists respond to these to the cosmological arguments, to the Kalam arguments? They respond rather poorly. They sort of say, well, okay, we understand that the universe had the beginning. The universe had to have a cause. Well, maybe the universe cause exists within itself. And they come up with these self-generating universes. That the universe is kind of like a flywheel that just keeps spinning off new universes all the time. And somehow they have this theory of self-generating universes. This is how bad it's getting for scientists. They have to come up with these theories like this that people at first would sort of say, what? You know? Because they are really stuck right now because the evidence is coming so strong for the existence of God. Okay? And in fact, one cosmologist sort of said that it's sort of like we're sort of saying we really don't really know how it happens, so we're brushing all our ignorance underneath the cosmic rug here. Okay? Or here's the other theory. The universe is oscillating. In other words, the concept here is that it's expanding and contracting, right? Okay? So what happens is the universe is expanding right now, but sooner or later it's going to contract. So it's like a bing, bang, 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 bang. Okay? But if you've ever noticed a ball falling off a thing, what ends up happening is it tends to fall the first time, then it falls more rapidly, and then more rapidly, sure, until eventually the ball doesn't do anything, right? Well, go back to second law of thermodynamics. If somebody pushed the universe off a building, so to speak, It might be big at one time, it might bounce for a while, but eventually if it's infinite, it's going to be the ball flat in the ground, right? So that doesn't explain their theory either, okay? They just can't get an infinite universe even when they look at the oscillating cosmos. So that leaves us with just two options. Either no one created something out of nothing, which, as you could tell, logically makes no sense, or you could sort of say someone created something out of nothing, and then really the bottom line is which view is more reasonable. And those are the things that you could talk about with your friends. I mean, you don't have to sit there and sort of say, well, those white-robed scientists really understand things and we don't. I mean, when you really get down to where their level of understanding is, you find out how vacuous it is when they eliminate God. So your question is why is there something rather than nothing at all? The other argument they'll come up with, well, if there has to be a cause to everything, what caused God? I mean, come on, he has to have a cause too, if everything needs to have a cause. But remember the argument said, only things that begin to exist have a cause. So you know what they've done to us? They've just helped us to find out that the cause of the universe has to be eternal. Okay? And once you start to sort of say, well, the cause of the universe has to be eternal, well, what's eternal? There's, you know, now you're already starting to confirming the fact that there's a God. So, and that's what the rest is. Therefore, God doesn't need a cause because he doesn't have a beginning. Okay? Well, how can we know what can we know about the cause of the universe? Well, because it's eternal, it transcends time, so it must, whatever caused it must be eternal. We know that it transcends space, so it must be infinite. We know that it transcends matter, so you know it has to be all-powerful because of what it made. And although we'll get to this next, in the teleological argument, the fact that this universe exists implies knowledge and our omnipotent God based upon design. Okay? And actually, let me just go through this because I said the same thing. Okay, arguments for the existence of God. I went through the cosmological argument. And so now let me go to the teleological argument. It kind of sounds like television. It's not that. All right, teleological argument. The biblical basis, remember, the heavens declare the glory of God, the big picture. The firmament shows his handiwork. So we're looking at it's just Psalm 19:1. This is just the second part, okay? So it's argued for the existence of the designer based upon design, okay, as opposed to arguing for the existence of a causer based upon the fact that it caused. And there's types of theological arguments. You can look at design of the universe as a whole, the design of environment to support life, or the design of life itself. And this really dated back to a guy named William Paley. And what William Paley did he was a theologian, not a scientist. But he said, suppose you're walking along the beach, and you're walking along the beach, and you stub yourself on your foot on something, and you look down, it's a seashell. You sort of say, okay, that's a seashell. That just came there. You stub your foot on a rock. I stub my foot a lot, so that's what happens to me too. Stub your foot on a rock, and you sort of say, oh, that's a rock. All of a sudden, you stub your foot on a watch. You sort of look at it, and you sort of say, well, this looks kind of different. You sort of see the movement and the mechanisms of the hands. You sort of see that looks like it's doing something. It has to be doing something. There seems to be some purpose in this thing, as opposed to just a rock which happened to be there. And you sort of see the movement of the hands, and then you also see all these intricate parts. And it looks like something put all these parts together, and you sort of say, gee, that just didn't happen. You know, somebody must have designed this. And so that's what the theological argument is. And it's pretty easy to look out there because, you know, most of us, we don't have to go to high school or college or beyond that. We can look at something and sort of say, well, that looks like it was cut by natural forces. Maybe that's not designed, although in a sense everything is, but that's not designed. It just kind of happened by natural forces. But you look at that and sort of say, some kind of weird natural force must have made that thing, you know? Or you sort of look at this one and sort of say, which one was caused by natural causes or which one was caused by intelligent causes? So the teleologic argument argues from design or intelligence, okay? Or look at this, sand dune. You know, we see those all the time. Again, some weird sort of sand dune must have blown that thing together there because, you know, you look at that and sort of said, there must be some intelligent design behind that one. So we don't need to have, it's intuitive to be able to tell between something that's designed and not designed. And so now we sort of say, okay, well, we can understand design now. Well, what about in the past? Well, if we look back in the past, we sort of see something way back when, and we sort of see the statue there. We sort of say, well, if there's Mount Rushmore nowadays, and we see something that's maybe not as grand in scale, but similar, we sort of say, well, if it had intelligent designer now, by the principle of uniformity, it probably had intelligent designer in the past. Okay? And so the question is who or what designed the universe? Well, again, there's only two possibilities. It either happened without intelligence, natural law, or it happened by intelligence or intelligent designer. So I want to talk about three things that are related to this. First of all, it's called the anthropic principle. And the anthropic principle sort of reveals, the fingerprint of the creator, or, to put it biblically, the firmament showeth his handiwork, okay? Now, there's a book came out about 2 or 3 years ago called The Privileged Planet. And basically, the premise of the book is that if you look at things inside the world, our world, the Earth, it's specifically designed to support life. And in fact, if you look at the oxygen content and mess with it. If it was above 25%, we'd have spontaneous fires everywhere. If it was below 16%, it couldn't support life. So now that's a little bit of a range, but you still have to have this range of oxygen. You have to have nitrogen in there because it's an inert gas that won't explode, so you have to have that. And so what you start to do is you start to look through different things as if some super intellect monkeyed around with physics and chemistry and biology in order to support life. So the argument for design is that this Earth was designed so that it could support life. So that basically you get this sort of list, okay? And I want to do this kind of like the Star Wars effect on the slide, but I didn't know how to do that. But those are all different constants that exist in this Earth. They have to do with different things that, if you will, a super intellect monkeyed around with so that it could support life on Earth, okay? So that's the anthropic principle. The next principle I want to talk about is about the life. Did life come by intelligent design, or did life kind of come by accident? Let's say you have a box of alphabets, and you spill over this box of alphabets, and out was a bunch of letters that came out all over the place. Now, the probability that those letters would come all over the place, who knows? I mean, you have 1 in 26, and one's got to be here, one's got to be here, so it might be 26 to the 15th power if you got 15 letters arranged there. Now, normally we don't sort of say, well, that's amazing. You know, that can only occur 26 to the 15th power. You know, this never occurs. Because, you know, it looks by random chances. But if you spilled over the thing and you got a message that said, John, take out the garbage, Mom says so, then you sort of say, well, wait a second. This just does, not only is it unlikely that you'd happen, but this actually has intellectual content there. So that's why it's so surprising. There's intellectual content there. There's language. Okay? Language with intellectual content. And that's what happens with the DNA. Now, to those of you who are not scientists, let me just sort of say this is sort of the rough cartoon structure of DNA. And it basically has four letters, A, T, C, and G. They stand for chemicals. You don't really know and have to know what they are. But what happens, those chemicals form a language. And you're not able to read the chart now. That's fine. The purpose was more to overwhelm you than to educate you. But behind this, there's the language of DNA, and for each of the three letters, they form words. There are 22 words. 20 are amino acids. One word is a stop, and one word start. Okay. So what you do is in order to get one protein, you have to have 100 amino acids. It's just a small protein. That's a little tiny little thing. I mean, it's just a little protein. I'll tell you, they come in bigger sizes. Little tiny protein. So you get the first tiny protein, you got to get 1 in 20 that first one is right. Right? Then to get the next one, it's 1 in 20 again, or 20 to the second power, then 20 to the third power. By the time you get one protein that's only 100 base pairs, which is 100 amino acids, which is pretty small, that's 20th to 100 power, which I don't know what it is, but that's a really big number. Okay? So that's what happens is that if you look inside the amoeba, the amount of information, language, that's written in the amoeba is equivalent to 1,000 volumes of an encyclopedia. That's the amount of information that's packed into a little amoeba cell. Now, of course, that all happened by accident. It all, you know, it's all just an accident, you know. It's all, by the way, little sidelight, I'm amazed how scientists can't believe in God. It just screams about the fact that Calvinism is true, because it's only through the blindness of man that you can't see this, because it just literally screams the Creator. I mean, when it says the heavens declare the handiwork, the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork, I mean, this thing is shouting. I mean, it is shouting to scientists, and it's only their sinfulness that prevents them from hearing it. So, now what about the brain? Actually, that could say the human brain or any DNA. The DNA that's located in each one of your cells right now has the equivalent of 20 million books. That would be enough books to stack each seat in the Madison Garden 10,000 books high. That's the amount of information that's in each one of your cells. I mean, it's incredible the amount of information that's there. I mean, when people sort of say much more than any computer, that's no joke. I mean, it is amazing that there. And to think that all that just happened by accident, that all that happened without design, that just was one of those things that just kind of happened, it just doesn't make any sense. There's no logical way to get around this. Third principle. We've talked about anthropic principle. We talked about the language of DNA. The third principle is what Michael Behe called irreducible complexity. And let me go over that real quickly. This is sort of, if you will, an answer to evolution or evolution, however you want to say it. You look at a mousetrap, okay? You get this mousetrap and you look at it and you sort of say, okay, here's this mousetrap right here. In order for this mousetrap to come into being, it has to have all the parts to come together to make the whole. In other words, a mousetrap can't evolve. Because if you just evolve the spring, well, the spring's just sitting there. What good's that? And even if you have the trap bar with the spring, it's just going to be sprung over. It's got to have a latch. And the latch has to have the trip mechanism. And you have to have a thing for the bait to be on the trip mechanism. So in order for a mousetrap to come together, it has to be put together all at once. Very carefully, mind you, otherwise you snap your fingers. So the mousetrap has to come together all together at once. That's called its irreducibly complex system. In other words, you may look at the parts, but the parts have to come together all at once. Otherwise, it's not a mousetrap. So it's not like you can add A, B, and C and get the mousetrap. It actually has to be put together in a certain fashion, a certain way, in order to create the mousetrap. Well, if we go from there, what about a cell? I mean, now when Darwin came up with the origin of life, he had no idea what cells were. He didn't know about that. They were talked about near his time, but nobody really understood them. And when they did understand them, they looked like kind of like sunny-side eggs, okay? They looked like this protoplasm, they had a little white thing in the center, and they sort of say, oh, okay, they kind of look like sunny-side eggs. But nowadays, with our sophisticated science, we can actually peer into there and see the complexity of the cells. Again, amazingly complex, the way the cells work. And then you go from cells, and each individual cell forms a bacterial flagellum. Now, I'm talking about this little bacterial flagellum. I mean, this bacterial flagellum, it's got rotors, it's got motors, it's got turners, it's got all these things that kind of twist the flagellum that spins about 60,000 times a second. And all this is to make this little tiny little bacterium swim. I mean, this little bacterium we can't even see. We don't have motors that are that efficient. And that's packed in this little tiny little bacterium. Amazingly complex. Talk about nanotechnology. I mean, this is amazing nanotechnology. But to those that don't believe in God, it just happened. It wasn't designed. It was just an accident. Or just natural forces. Okay? Oh, there's Richard Dawkins. Like it or not, he's designed too. I mean, he doesn't want to admit it, but Richard Dawkins was designed. And so, although right now he doesn't glorify God, at some point he will. Okay? All right. The teleologic argument. Every design has a designer. The anthropic principle, the language of DNA, the principle of irreducible complexity verify that the life and universe were designed. Therefore, both the universe and life has a designer. Okay. So how do they respond to this? I mean, obviously, they have to come up with some reason that why we're not true. Well, what they do is they redefine science. And again, they say science is only explanation of natural causes. Well, is that a scientific argument? No. It's a philosophical argument. So they're using a philosophical argument to support science, but that's not science. So that's part of the philosophy of science. It's not really science. So the rebuttal is that we shouldn't be looking for just any explanation. What best fits the evidence? That's really the foundation of science. What best fits the evidence? And if that leads you to a supernatural cause, well, praise God. Because not only is that true, but that's praises God. What they'll do is they'll just sort of say, we're lucky. Well, I mean, let's face it. We just went over all this stuff. I mean, they come up with self-generating universes. They come up with the fact that there are a million universes out there. That we were just lucky. But if you look at the odds of any of these things actually occurring, particularly since they communicate information and generate information like DNA, I mean, it's not just lucky. It has a, if you will, a super cosmic force that's causing this to all occur, even if they don't want to admit that, okay? They also sort of say, well, you know, Christians are basically a bunch of deluded superstition folks. And back in the 17th century, when lightning would hit a roof, they'd say, oh, it's God. Well, I still think it is God, but they'd sort of say, it's God. And then when they came up with natural laws and they discovered natural laws, they'd sort of say, aha, this is just electricity. We put a lightning rod on here. We can tame the lightning. Man has become God. You know, it's funny how that theme keeps coming up. But anyways, So what they sort of say is, really, what Christianity is left is just explain the God of the gaps. In other words, God just fills in things you don't really understand. But we didn't say we don't understand this. I mean, what we're sort of saying is we understand how complex the cell is. You scientists can't explain it apart from God. We understand how much language there is in DNA. You scientists are the ones that can't explain it. You're the ones coming up with these self-generating universe theories, not us. So the rebuttal is not that we lack evidence. It's not like we're putting in God in the gap. What we're sort of saying is, look at all this evidence out there. It's screaming the fact that God exists. Theory of everything. What's the theory of everything? The theory of everything is that physicists sort of say, well, since matter can become energy and energy become matter, and there's interrelationship between that type of energy and nuclear forces, maybe there's some sort of overarching, well, it's actually God, but they don't want to admit that, some overarching force that kind of ties everything together, ties together the nuclear constant, the gravitational constant, the charge constant, all this other stuff. So what they do is they sort of say, we just haven't discovered what that theory of everything is. And the answer is, yes, you haven't, because it's God. But they don't want to admit that. So the rebuttal is that, yes, actually the theory of everything is that it's God. And they sort of say, well, the reason you come up with design is because it's religiously motivated. You know, you just are trying to defend your faith, and so that's why you come up with this. But so what? I mean, who cares what my motivation is? If I get to the truth, who cares what my motivation is? In other words, there's a fallacy called a red herring. In other words, they have you arguing about things that aren't central to the argument. I mean, the central argument here is there design? Is there a designer? Who cares what my motivation is? That's a red herring. We don't go down, or a rabbit trail. We don't go down that thing, okay? And it's based upon evidence, as we talked about. Okay, so now we're going to get to the little two, and this is very quick, so don't worry, we're not going to really spend an hour and a half, okay? All right, ontological. All right, ontological, let me go on to that one. Anselm, 1077, I think that's when he wrote his treatise on this. He actually was a Catholic saint that knew about the arguments for the existence of God, but thought that they were so complex, and so he came up with what he thought was a very simple argument for the existence of God, that most people don't understand, and it's hard to explain. But we'll try it anyway. What he came up with is the fact that God is the greatest conceivable being. Yeah, I mean, everybody can understand that. So God is the greatest conceivable being. And certainly to exist must be greater than to not exist, right? I mean, something that is a whole lot better than something that is not, right? So therefore, the greatest conceivably exists, therefore God exists. Sounds pretty good. Okay, so let's conceive of the perfect island. I can conceive of a perfect island. To exist is better, more perfect than to not exist. Therefore, the perfect exists, or does it? Okay? So Anselm's argument, the first part of his argument was like that the greatest conceivable being exists. Most people laugh at it now because they sort of say, well, you know, if that's the case, you know, is it better for me to have money in my pocket than not to have money? Well, of course it is. I can conceive it, so therefore there must be money in my pocket. Doesn't work that way. But Anselm actually had part two. And believe it or not, 10 centuries later, they're still arguing about whether or not this is a valid argument or not. So the fact that they haven't been able to put this away must mean there's something there for philosophers that are a lot smarter than me. But I'll try to go through it with you. Let's go through it. Beings exist, okay? You exist, I exist, okay, we exist, okay? Next part about that. In rank, there must be a greatest being, okay? In other words, you know, we do that all the time. We play in a football field, somebody wins the game, somebody's greater than another, maybe for that moment or whatever. But in beings, there must be some sort of greatest being, okay? There just has to be in the scheme of thing. Now, a being with necessary existence is much greater than a being with contingent existence, right? In other words, none of us had to be here. I mean, not here at Berean Bible Church today. I mean, nobody had to be born. God, just by his grace, allowed that to happen. Or designed it. So a being with necessary existence is greater than one with contingent existence. And we said that God is the greatest conceivable being. So God must have this property. The greatest conceivable being must have a property of necessary existence. Therefore, God exists. And that argument actually pretty much holds water now. Because it basically says that God being a necessary being, because that's his property, God's property is necessary existence. He's the great uncaused one. Therefore, he obviously has to exist. So people still argue about that one, but we're not going to go into the debates about that. Axiological, that's also known as the moral argument, and it goes like this. if God does not exist, then objective morals do not exist. Now, you know, when you get these double negatives, it really hurts your brains. But they do this technique a lot in philosophy. It's called confirming the contrapositive. But basically, you look at it a different way, which is read it backwards. Objective morals exist, therefore God exists. Or let me, I'm sorry, I've got myself confused here. Let me just leave it there for right now because I got myself confused. But objective morals exist, therefore God exists. Let me just give you some examples. So if God does not exist, what would be our basis for objective morals? In other words, would it be common consensus? In other words, everybody in society sort of says this is what's right or wrong? Well, if that's the case, then whoever's in power or might makes right. Since Hitler thought that it was right to kill the Jews, was that right? Well, if you don't believe in objective morals, maybe. So you're stuck with the fact that, you know, there's objective morals there. And then the question is that if some of us are selfish, I know some of us might be, well, how'd that happen? Did that happen because we got selfish genes? I mean, what in it made us selfish versus somebody that's non-selfish? You know, we realize that being selfish is not quite right, so where did these objective morals come from? And then we sort of say, but we believe that objective morals exist. For example, no society thinks that you could torture children for sport, and that's a great sport, you know? And if you don't believe objective morals exist, get ready to punch somebody. And all of a sudden, they'll realize that objective morals exist. You can't invade their physical space, you know? Or if they don't believe that reality exists, just ask them for their paycheck, because that's not real anyway, you know? I mean, although the philosophers might talk a lot about the fact that objective morals don't exist, our very walking through this earth very much screams the fact that objective morals exist. At least, how can you possibly relate to anybody else unless you thought that they did exist, even though they deny it, okay? But the critics sort of say that morality has evolved as a matter of instinct, but that's obviously not the case because these have been established in God and they're eternal. So, actually, let me back up. Oops, let me do that. So now what happens is now I put tools in your toolbox. And I know that they've been very quick and superficial, and we sort of highlighted on them. And each of these you could spend a lot more time talking about. But basically, I think what the arguments for the existence of God do is they strengthen your faith from attacks from those from atheistic thought. Remember, out there, there are lots of people reading lots of things that state that God is just a mere delusion. And the reason they like to read that kind of stuff is that it confirms their own desire to be sinners. Okay? You know, that's what sinners do. They like to remain as sinners. So because of that, they'll read books like that and sort of say, well, you Christians are deluded, and you know, and they have books that support that. So when they come up and attack your faith and sort of say, well, you know, isn't evolution true, or you know, hasn't the earth existed for billions and billions of years? You know, hopefully these arguments for the existence of God will strengthen your own faith from atheistic thought. Number two, it allows you to provide defense and answers to those that are attacking you. Instead of just being on the defensive and retreating and sort of say, well, you know, chocolate ice cream's good for you, ice cream's vanilla's for me, God's good for me, God's not good for you, it's all kind of happy. You know, you're not saying that. You're sort of saying, you know, it's not the fact that they can come up with these things that say God is a delusion, but rather you can come up with evidence, arguments to support the fact that God does exist. So this will allow you to intellectually be prepared to confront our culture boldly, because you'll have the answers. In other words, you don't have to be afraid that you're going to come across somebody that's going to say something to you and you're like, I don't really know about that, you know. Because I think although it's important for the church to be trained in the scriptures, and that's a key and vital important, if we're going to be talking to atheists, people that don't believe in God, you can use all the biblical arguments you want, and they're just going to kind of throw it out because they don't want to hear that. But it's going to be a little hard to throw out stuff like this because they can't throw out the intricacies of design or the cause of the universe. And maybe by the grace of God, because that's the only thing that does convert human beings, you might bring some intellectual persons to faith. Because let's face it, God said that he did not choose many wise, but he didn't say he chose any of them. So there's some wise ones out there that he's actually chosen to salvation. And maybe you'll be the key to bring them to faith. Because, you know, there's a lot of people that pontificate in the high intellectual realm, but they've actually never been challenged with the fact that the evidence out there screams for the existence of God. Okay, thanks.